Good afternoon. I call this meeting of the Job Growth, Energy Affordability, Policy, and Finance Committee to order. Today is Tuesday, February 21st. First order of business is approval of the minutes from February 15th. Representative Mahoney moves approval of the minutes from February 15th. Is there any corrections, changes, or additions? Seeing none, all those in favor, please signify by saying aye. Opposed, say nay. Motion prevails, and the minutes are adopted. Well, members, we have a new addition to the Job Growth, Energy Affordability, Policy, and Finance Committee team. If you look over on this side, the newest member of the Minnesota House of Representatives, Representative Ann New, has been added to our committee. And so we want to welcome Representative New. Representative New, did you have any comments? And did you want to share with us, if you could be an animal, what animal would you be and why?
Okay, great.
You got to talk into the microphone, Representative New. So.
See, I've got so much to learn. Some sort of cat or tiger.
And why is that?
Because I look really cute and little, but I can be aggressive and get stuff done.
Great. All right. Well, you'll fit in just fine in this committee then, especially the troublemakers on this side. So, well, Representative New, welcome to the committee, and you get some early action today right away. So, first bill we're going to have is Representative Barr. Now, Representative Barr, is this your first time to the committee?
It is the first time to the committee chair.
And I see that we have some treats for the that is from you, Representative Barr?
And I'd like to give a tip to Representative New that the first time you present to a committee, the rule is, or the unwritten rule is, that you bring treats. So make a note of that somewhere.
Oh, it's not unwritten. It's definitely written. It's definitely so. And so, members, since Representative Barr brought these treats in, I see no reason to have the formality of a hearing or to take action. We'll just count it as good. So, no. The chair will move House File 587 for possible inclusion in a later bill. Representative Barr, first of all, thank you for the treats. It was very nice of you. Do you are any of these amendments, are these yours?
Yes, they are my amendments.
All right. Now, my understanding is one of the amendments needs to be have a technical change. There was a drafting error in that.
Yes.
Okay,
yes,
so let's take the one that does not have the error. Which one is that?
Okay, so that would be Amendment 2, Mr. Chair.
Which one, Representative Barr?
Amendment A2, Mr. Chair.
All right, so the chair will move the A2 amendment. Looks like this is, do you want to explain or should I have staff explain the amendment? Mr. Weeks, or looks like you're just making sure that the percentage of the
Yes, Mr. Chair. Previously it said must pay a certain amount, and we're just trying to clarify the language so that it meets the intent of what I had intended there.
Understood. Is there any discussion to the amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, say nay. Motion prevails. The A2 amendment is adopted. Representative Barr, now the A4 amendment is the one that needs a technical change?
Yes, it does.
So we can go to nonpartisan staff. Could be a, oh, they may not know. Well, Representative Barr, why don't you tell us what this is then?
So the original language stated that it would be required to, or the Department of Commerce would be required to place an ad in the newspaper or with a larger circulation, and we're trying to clarify that. It's, we want to remove circulation, and it should be of general. So the word that, the only word that needs to be removed is circulation.
Okay, so Representative Barr moves a, or Chair will move an oral amendment to the A4 amendment. This is to strike the word circulation from line 1.7?
Correct.
Okay, so the way this would read then, let me just go over this with everyone. The list must be published in the qualified newspaper. Circulation in each county. Is that, the staff have that? Representative Barr, so are you is your oral amendment to the amendment, the A4 amendment, is that what you're changing?
Yes.
Okay, so.
Sorry.
And so we have, does nonpartisan staff figure out what's going on? Because
I believe we've got that now.
Okay.
I'm looking for it right now through chair.
Yes, could you just take a second just to walk through that again?
Anna Shalom, nonpartisan research. Chair and members, I believe the amendment now is just changing to say that the list must be published in the qualified newspaper of general circulation.
Correct.
In each county.
Gotcha. Okay.
And that's correct, Mr. Chair.
All right, so I will incorporate that change into the A4 amendment. Is there any discussion on the A4 amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, say nay. Motion prevails. The A4 amendment is adopted. Representative Barr, I believe the bill is now in the form that you would like. To your presentation.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And members, this bill is referred to as the Unclaimed Property Bill, and what we're trying to do here is start to remove the $700 million in assets that are on the general ledger of the state and take more aggressive action, if you will, to get those dollars back into the hands of Minnesotans. So this bill does a couple of different things. One, it requires the Department of Commerce to contract with an outside vendor. The thought behind that is typically with these assets, they begin to age. So they sit with a company, they become inactive or determined as unclaimed after the first after 1 year of returned mail or something along those lines. Those companies turn those assets over within 3 years to the state. Prior, it used to be after 7 years. So what's happening is we are collecting those unclaimed assets at a much higher rate, and we're growing that $700 million asset in assets each year. So we want to contract with a third party with the understanding is that those assets require more specialized handling, and we think that a third party who specializes in that can do that. The second thing that it does is it requires that the department list on its website a list of owners of those assets by in alphabetical order, and the reason that's important is right now they're required to list it on a website called missingmoney.com. And by the way, if you haven't, I would encourage you to go out and look at that website, see if you've got some assets out there. So what happens is it's a little bit cumbersome. You have to enter in first name and last name, and it's a little difficult for if you're trying to just go quickly and scan. So it would require that listing. It would also require advertising, and that's where that technical correction came in. And they would be required to advertise assets of $500 or more in a local publication. And what's really important about that is sometimes people say, well, you know, isn't it enough that we list it on the website? And I always like to think of my mom. She's 75 years old. I know this may shock some of you. She doesn't have an email account. She doesn't even own a computer. God bless her. And so to make sure that some of the folks that that we have equal access, I guess, to those funds, it also requires some additional public notice, including utilizing the Internet and Facebook and other types of social media and social media-type advertising. And then finally, it does require reporting in two ways. One, it does require the Department of Commerce to provide a list alphabetically by zip to each of the members of the legislature so that they can make attempts to publicize that themselves or even depending if they want to take a look at that list and try to help people locate their monies. In addition, it does require the Department of Commerce to provide a report to the legislature in February of each year. So those are the modifications to the current unclaimed asset statutes, and I'll open it up for questions, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Do you have any other testifiers, Representative Barr? Testifiers.
Not at this time.
This is a public hearing. Are there any members of the public wish to testify in favor or voice concerns with the bill? Mr. Brickwitty, are you here? Okay. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Mr. Chairman, for the record, Peter Brickwitty from the Commerce Department. I want to say thank you to Representative Barr for bringing this bill forward. We did have an extensive discussion on the policy merits in the Commerce Committee. Commerce has supported similar legislation that's been brought forward by a bipartisan group of legislators over the years. I'd like to say particularly that we really like the idea of increased advertising and have no issues with the increased reporting and accountability in Representative Barr's bill. We do have a fiscal note on the bill with the impact to the agency. Happy to take questions from members on that section. I would note we do have concerns about the first section, the outsourcing of the return of property to a third-party vendor. We do have the technical expertise to do returns of property. We have had a record-breaking year in our last fiscal year. We returned in the last fiscal year over 30,000 properties with a value of just under $50 million to Minnesotans. So we know how to do the job. We just don't have dedicated resources at the agency to do the work. Mr. Chairman, I'll leave it there. Happy to answer questions about our fiscal note or other issues related to the bill, but thanks for the opportunity.
Mr. Chair, may I comment?
Oh, sure, but Representative Barr.
So I just wanted to comment. My predecessor is the one who initially teed up this bill last year, and who's very pleased to see that I was bringing it forward this year. And he made extensive efforts on his own last year to really go out of his way to publicize. In fact, he requested a list from the Department of Commerce, and he spent 10 minutes a day for 3 weeks to see what he could do just using Google, white pages, and those kinds of resources, free, available on the website. And with 10 minutes a day over 3 weeks, he was able to locate in his district $300,000 of unclaimed assets. So I want to respectfully dispute, you know, the fact that my colleague here is saying that he that his department has the expertise. My premise is that the longer these assets age, the more specialized expertise is required to actually place them. And I do believe a large part of that return, and again, no disrespect to your team, was because my predecessor was able to garner significant publicity, editorials, TV coverage, and so forth, which I think really helped elevate unclaimed assets and was partly responsible for those returns.
And Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Brickwood.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Barr, I was not intending to be in disagreement with you on that point. Actually, the efforts on the part of former Representative Atkins, Representative Hansen, and Senator Metzen last year, they did a project. They requested a list, and we are generally supportive of the idea of deputizing all of you into helping us provide information to consumers out in Minnesota about unclaimed property that belongs to them. I think that's a wonderful idea. The return rate on that particular project was about 25%, roughly. Our return rate at the department last year on the program as a whole was 50%. The national average is in the high 30s to 40%. So no disagreement whatsoever. I think the idea of more advertising using legislators who have a wonderful distribution network to your constituents to provide information is wonderful. I would echo Representative Barr's encouragement for you all to go to missingmoney.com and check to see if you have property. I remember, Mr. Chairman, when the commissioner was here to present on the agency's budget a couple of years ago, we brought a list of committee members, and there were several members who did have property valued to them. In fact, I seem to recall Representative Portman may have had a property of 1 cent that was due to her. I don't know if she went through the trouble of claiming it. But nevertheless, I think that's a wonderful idea. We just would take issue with the notion that a third-party vendor would be able to, in a more cost-effective manner, be able to return property to consumers than the agency would be able to do so if we had dedicated resources.
So, Mr. Brickery, what is the department doing to reduce the backlog of unclaimed property? Not to increase the claims return, because I think there's some scale that's going on there, but to actually decrease the total amount that the government's in possession of.
Mr. Chairman, the challenge that we face is that the legislature has dedicated resources for unclaimed property compliance. So we have dedicated funding for staffing to do compliance work, to bring unclaimed property that belongs to Minnesotans, that is in the holder environment, so belonging to companies, that has not been returned to consumers, to be turned over in compliance with the unclaimed property statute. That's the primary driver for the growth in the fund balance over the last several years in particular. So we're doing everything that we can to return property to consumers and to reduce that dollar value balance. As I said, last year we had a record-breaking year, both in terms of total claims returned and the total value of the property that was returned, just under $50 million. The challenge that we have is we're not in balance. We have dedicated resources to bring property to the state. We don't have dedicated resources to return it out to consumers, which we see to be the primary purpose of the program.
Mr. Brickwitty, if the department's doing everything they can to return unclaimed property to the rightful owners, why is it that they can't find members of the Minnesota House of Representatives who have unclaimed property?
Mr. Chairman, excellent question. We can, and the question is how best to distribute that information. So, again, we're very supportive of efforts to increase advertising to the program. We just don't have the staff to do that on a full-time dedicated basis. We do everything we can to both process claims that come in from Minnesotans who are trying to claim their property and also conduct events and conduct outreach throughout the state, as best we can to return property. It's just without dedicated resources, we don't have people who are able to do that job full time because we have to operate the rest of the program.
Perhaps you might have misunderstood my question. I mean, there are members of the Minnesota House of Representatives who are listed on the unclaimed property directory right now. like sitting members of the Minnesota legislature. So what is the process here that how would getting more FTEs resolve this problem? They're literally in this building right now, and the Department of Commerce is saying they can't find them.
Mr. Chairman,
you get more special treatment than our constituents?
No, I'm just saying that it'd be like saying
it. Like that, Mr. Chairman.
No, Representative Mahoney. First of all, you should seek recognition before talking. Second of all, what I'm saying is that's pretty easy. I mean, like they're in this room. So, is the department going to be doing anything different?
Mr. Chairman, my apologies for not being clear. My point is not that we can't find members of the legislature or find Minnesotans. The question is, do we have the staffing to be able to execute the project of returning that property to members of the legislature or members of the public? The finding people is not the problem, although we would like to do it at a much greater scale than we are able to do it today. It's the processing the actual claims that come associated with it, which would be the same situation that if House File 587 were to be passed into law, that the vendor would be working to try to find members of the legislature or other members of the public to return property to them.
And so in 2007, we had the unclaimed property balance was about $350 million. How many years will it take Commerce right now to reduce the unclaimed balance to get to that level right now at the current rate that things are being paid at?
Mr. Chairman, I don't know if I can answer that question definitively. Again, our return rate this past fiscal year was 50%, and even though we returned nearly $50 million to unclaimed property owners, the fund balance did grow. And again, what's driving that is we have dedicated resources on the compliance side to bring unclaimed property that belongs to Minnesotans to the state so that it can be returned. But we don't have dedicated resources on the other side of the equation to return property out. So we have four people working on bringing money in, no people who are dedicated solely like the compliance staff is to returning property. We do as much and as best as we can, and I think we've done a nice job.
So as that account balance grows, does that negatively impact the Department of Commerce at all? I mean, what skin in the game does the Department of Commerce have in that?
Mr. Chairman, I don't know if I understand your question.
So every year we're seeing the balance grow, Mr. Brickwitty. So we're up to close to $700 million last year. This is it's double what it was in 2007. As that balance gets bigger, is there an administrative cost to administrating the larger balance and keeping track of all this stuff? Does it become more burdensome from an administrative perspective?
Mr. Chairman, no, there's not an increased cost to the department. I would note that the governor's budget does include some funding for improving our computer systems, both from a data practices and security standpoint, and also a claims administration standpoint to make our job easier, to make it easier for claimants to use our system, and also to make it easier for holders to report unclaimed property to the state.
And then my last question, then we'll go to members' questions. So who at the department is responsible for reducing the fund balance?
Mr. Chairman, I don't know if there is a direction to any one specific person at the agency to reduce the fund balance. Again, the growth in the fund balance is primarily attributable to the dedicated resources that we have for compliance. They've increased compliance returns and achievements to the state.
And is there
in the last several years.
Is there an estimate, Mr. Brickwitty, for at the end of fiscal year 18, like a target for where the Department of Commerce wants to be for the balance?
Mr. Chairman, I would like to, on the balance, I don't know, Mr. Chairman, I would say our goal is every year to be better in terms of returning more property back to their rightful owners every single year.
Representative Neuberger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Two questions. The first question I have has to do with unclaimed vanilla cupcakes. If you could, we could probably find someone to claim them down here. The second question I have is talking about this $700 million fund. Oh, ask and you shall receive. The second question I have is the $700 million fund balance. Is that being held in an interest-bearing account? And if so, how much? Well, first of all, is it being held in an interest-bearing account?
Mr. Brickwitty.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Neuberger, the unclaimed property fund is held in the general fund.
All right. Thank you.
Representative Neuberger.
That's it.
Representative Mahoney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Brickley, I just want a yes or no answer to this. Yes. yes or no. How many people do you have? I guess you can't do a yes or no. How many people do you have now working on or FTE equivalent, FTEs, working on getting the money out of the fund, finding people, doing all the other stuff that goes along with that?
Mr. Berkowitz.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Mahoney, we do not currently have any dedicated resources for FTEs for returning properties to Minnesotans. We have four FTEs that are dedicated specifically to compliance activities. So the rest of the staff does as much claims return as possible throughout the year.
So, Mr. Chair, Mr. Berkowitz, if you were given $1.329 million, how many FTEs would you put, if you had $1.329 million, how many FTEs would you be able to put on to go out and find people?
At that rate, they could hire another Peter Brickwoody, right?
Or
Mr. Brickwoody.
Mr. Chairman, I would take that bill. I would support you if you wanted to put that in. Mr. Chairman, Representative Mahoney, I can't do the math that quickly. I was a poli-sci major in college, but I can tell you the total budget for the unclaimed property program today is less than $1.329 million. So it would more than double the entire staff.
So, Representative Mahoney, since you brought it up and Mr. Brickwoody answered the question, Mr. Brickwoody, can you just cover that assumption in the fiscal note of how you get to the $1.3 million?
Mr. Chairman, certainly. Mr. Chairman, you're referring to our assumption regarding the cost of the vendor?
Right. Page 3 of the fiscal note underneath the table, that first paragraph.
So, Mr. Chairman, we in reading the language of the bill, which would allow, and again, Mr. Chairman, this was obviously before seeing the amendment. This was drawn to the first engrossment. The language of the first engrossment requires the agency to turn over the program of returning property to a third-party vendor and allows them to be paid up to 7% commission on returns. So we took the rolling five-year average of the total value of the program and dollars returned over the last 5 years and did a calculation off of that.
So, Mr. Brickwoody, would it be correct that the assumption of the fiscal note is that any unclaimed property that would be returned, that the commission would automatically go back to the RFP holder?
Mr. Chairman, to the vendor, our assumption is that the vendor would take over the return of property project, if you will, in full from the
state. So, Representative Barr, is it your intent that any unclaimed property that's returned automatically be credited to the vendor, or just the ones that the vendor has gone out and acquired on behalf of the property owners?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My assumption would be it would just be those that they located.
All right, Representative Mahoney. So we kind of so that's where the fiscal note. Obviously, the assumption in the fiscal note needs to be redrawn because I've read the bill. This is Representative Atkins' bill. This was not the interpretation last year when we had this bill, but that's kind of a new item that the fiscal note would be $1.3 million. Certainly, if that were accurate, I don't think anyone in this committee would support the bill. But certainly for the new property that could be dedicated to the vendor, that they could ascribe to it would be a much lower cost. But Representative Mahoney.
Well, Mr. Chair, if following the conversation here, or the testimony here, if a vendor returned, I think it's a five-year average of $33 million, because it's all turned over to them, they're in charge of it. And the way this bill is written, they're in charge of returning that money. I still think it's well over $1 million at least. So my question comes back to an FTE is somewhere between $90,000 to $125,000 by the time all the benefits are done. You're talking somewhere between 8 and 9 employees to do this. What you're doing is enriching a this is reverse debt collection, I guess. I don't know what the hell to call it. when the state has done a very good job here at $33 million, it would be nice that they did $700 million and got rid of it all. I get that. But this is just this is outsourcing government to a private enterprise, to the author. Is this essentially just outsourcing a government function to a private entity?
Representative Barr.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I look at it as more a public-private partnership whereby we could utilize the staff to provide oversight in terms of what that third-party vendor is doing to return those assets.
Representative Mahoney.
Mr. Chair, I'm not sure how the Mr. Chair, let's say we did do the pass this bill and send it along. According to the fiscal note here, it's at least one, you know, and I don't have my reading glasses on, but maybe it's one and a half FTEs to oversee all of this. This doesn't, before I ask that, Mr. Birkwoody, how many people, how many FTEs would you need to perform the function that is outlined in this bill?
Mr. Birkwoody.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Mahoney, last session, Representative Atkins had a very similar bill that provided funding for two FTEs at the department. So I think, I would take as many FTEs as we could possibly do to return over $700 million worth of property that does not belong to the state to its rightful owners. But last year, the department's fiscal note on that proposal was for two FTEs.
So,
Representative Mahoney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and then I'm going to be done here. It just seems like we're giving away unclaimed properties to a private entity that the state has said that they can do better and cheaper. I'm not sure this is a good bill at this particular point, and even if the bill passes, they're going to need one FTE and to oversee what the vendor will be doing. So for the extra $190,000 to $120,000, I think we might get the same results.
Representative Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'd like to sign up to be that vendor because I can't think of anything better than calling people up and saying, hey, you've got some money coming to you. What a great job that would be. Next to being like Ed McMahon in the Publisher's Clearinghouse or something. But question for you on the process. So if somebody calls now, they find out that they have some money coming to them, according to that website, and they call the Department of Commerce. Kind of walk through what happens, if you would, please.
Mr. Birkwoody.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Scott, it depends on the nature of the property. If it is a simple claim, I'll use myself. I had a year and a half, 2 years ago, a $24.25 check from a previous employer. That was a very simple claim. It was processed within 48 hours electronically using our electronic processing system. Most small dollar claims and even some larger dollar claims that are quite simple, it's Representative Scott's old payroll check as opposed to something that belongs to an heir or something like that. Those claims can be processed within 48 hours. Larger, more complex claims, larger dollar amounts, and also claims particularly related to securities that may be more complex related to the distribution of funds or the ownership of the funds, and properties that have multiple owners. So particularly with heir claims, you may have, individual who owned property in a cooperative utility. That cooperative utility has gone out of business. That original owner has died, and so now several generations have gone by. That property now has come to the state. You could have multiple owners of the same property. So it can become much more complex to actually process a claim, and the time frame can be somewhat longer. Our effort at the department is to try to make that customer service experience as pleasant as possible, particularly when we're dealing with claims that have multiple owners, because sometimes one owner will know that they have a claim and submit a claim for the entire amount, and they may find that they only are entitled to a portion of it. So these things can get complex. So it really does depend on the nature of the property in terms of what exactly the process would be. I would note, I think Representative Barr's bill, at least in part, would require us to help detail that information and report to the legislature to help make it clear, and we're supportive of that idea.
Representative Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Birkwoody, if it's an instance where someone is deceased and the surviving, let's say that their spouse is still living but has dementia, and so there's a power of attorney, but the deceased person has some money setting an account, what kind of documentation would you need? Would just the proof that this person acting as the power of attorney is now the power of attorney, what other documentation might you need?
Mr. Brickwoody.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Scott, excellent question. Again, it depends on the nature of the property, but we would need documentation in that sort of specific case of power of attorney of original ownership. We usually would need information about the marriage license as well. So it depends, again, if it's, say, a security or a mutual fund, it can be more complex because we need more information to prove out ownership on that type of property than, say, an old utility or paycheck.
Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The reason I ask is I have a friend who is in this situation, and they were asked by the department to provide a copy of a 40-page trust to be sent in. Now, I would think that you would just be able to get the, you know, the cover page or two of the trust that lays out the legalities. And then the concern now, of course, is so you send in this 40-page trust, and it's sitting on someone's desk for all to see. And so I have a concern there that people's private information is exposed to. And why would the Department of Commerce need to see a 40-page trust if the front page or the initial documents contain the information that you needed?
Mr. Brickwood.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, and of course I'm not familiar with the specific circumstances in that case. Trust cases can be some of the most complex ones that we deal with. And again, not knowing the specifics of why we asked for the entire trust document, I can't speak to that specifically. I would say that we share your concern about private data. We take that very seriously. As I mentioned earlier, the governor's budget has some funding to allow us to upgrade our data security systems and the electronic platform that we use. So I share your concern wholeheartedly. We want to make sure that the information that we're gathering to prove ownership of a property is appropriate, the minimum amount necessary to prove ownership, and that we're not requiring individuals to provide us with private data or non-public data without reason or inappropriately.
Final question. Thank you, Mr. Chair. So what do you do with that data once you've given the money back? What do you do with a 40-page trust or this information that has Social Security numbers and all sorts of things? What are you doing with that?
Mr. Brickwood.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Scott, that data, if we were to obtain private data on individuals, it is not retained in our system in any way. It would be disposed of appropriately in the event that the property is then claimed and the claim is processed.
Thank you.
Representative Mayquid.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Barr, are there vendors that already exist that do this?
Representative Barr.
Mr. Chair, Representative Mayquid, yes, there are.
Representative Mayquid.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Would you tell me who they are? I'm just trying to think of who would do this, and I've never heard of one.
Representative Barr.
Sorry, Mr. Chair. Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Mayquid. I didn't bring a list of the names, but I did Google it, and a list came up, and then I specifically looked at a few that had been ranked A-plus or better by the Better Business Bureau, and then made some inquiry just to make sure that they would actually be interested in working with a government entity to do that kind of work, and that's as far as my search went.
Representative Mayquid.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And does this happen in other states, too?
Representative Barr.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Mayquid, yes, it does.
Representative Mayquid.
Do you know which states?
Representative Barr.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Mayquid, I'm pretty sure it happens in every state.
Representative Mayquid.
That's it. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Yep. Representative Vogel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And possibly to Commerce Department person, is the Commerce Department now getting, and I might have missed this with all the conversation, funds from that account right now?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Vogel, no.
Representative Vogel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So Commerce isn't paid anything out of the fund right now to employ people or to do any administration of it?
Mr. Brickwood.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Vogel, no, we are not.
Okay, thank you.
Is revenue generated for the general fund from that?
Mr. Chairman, is revenue generated from the unclaimed property?
Interest on the unclaimed property, is that generated for the general fund?
Mr. Chairman, I would defer to my colleagues at MMB. My understanding, the general fund is an interest-bearing account, but it is full of non-dedicated revenue, so I couldn't attribute $1 from the unclaimed property program generating, you know, say, a dollar of interest for the general fund. My understanding is the State Board of Investment does small investments out of the general fund to help cash flow state government, but I would defer to my colleagues from the MMB for a more specific and precise answer.
But there is interest, there is an investment return on the unclaimed property right now that the state realizes.
Mr. Chairman, again, I would defer to MMB. I don't know if you could attribute an investment return to a specific portion of the unclaimed property.
I'll ask the question a different way then. How about this? Does the unclaimed property get paid interest?
Mr. Chairman, does an unclaimed property claim...
Does the state that is in possession of unclaimed property, does it collect interest?
Mr. Chairman, unclaimed property that resides with the state is held in the general fund. So, again, I would defer to MMB on whether or not you could attribute any interest or investment returns to a specific non-dedicated dollar like the unclaimed property fund dollars are in the general fund.
Mr. Brickwitty, does the unclaimed property have any investment return?
Again, Mr. Chairman, I don't know if I can answer that
question. You answered earlier and you said yes. So you can say the same. You don't have to change the answer. We asked this question earlier. My point is there an investment return for the unclaimed property that's in possession of the state?
Mr. Chairman, my answer earlier was that the general fund is invested or there are small investments made out of the general fund is my understanding from MMB. I do not know if MMB attributes any specific investment returns to any specific account within the general fund.
Okay, I'm going to try this again.
And Mr. Chairman, my apologies. I'm not trying to be coy or just change my answer.
So, Mr. Brickwitty, right now we have $700 million in possession of the state of Minnesota. Does that $700 million collect interest or have any rate of return? Mr. Brickwitty.
Mr. Chairman, the unclaimed property fund is held within the general fund. Again, I would defer to MMB to more accurately explain how the MMB invests portions of the general fund.
Is there anyone from MMB here? Come on down. Are there any other members of the department who are public who wish to testify in favor or voice concerns with the bill? Good afternoon. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Hello. My name is Marianne Convoy, and I'm the Executive Budget Officer for the Economic Development Bill Area.
Did you get any treats yet?
No, not yet.
So the question is, right now, the latest numbers we have are about $700 million in unclaimed property. Can you explain how that unclaimed property, I mean, where it resides, whether interest is paid on it, if there's any rate of return on it?
Sure. So I wish I knew more details specifically about how that works. To be honest, I'm not an expert in this, but the basic understanding I have is that the unclaimed property is revenue into the general fund, and that revenue, if it's cash, that cash flow is part of the general fund complement of revenue that short-term investments are made on that do gain interest for the state.
And those investments would then flow back into the general fund?
Correct.
Thank you.
Yep.
Are there any other members of the public who wish to testify in favor or voice concerns with the bill? Seeing none, we'll close the public comment portion and move to member questions. And seeing no further member questions, I'll make my closing comment, and then Representative Barr is the author. You get the final word. I would say one of the members of this committee earlier on said the Commerce Department is doing a very good job with these funds. We've seen the amount of unclaimed property double to $700 million. I don't think that's a really good job. If that's a really good job, I'd hate to see what a bad job is. I think it was a good idea when Representative Atkins had this last session, and I think it's a good idea that you've got it now, Representative Barr, so I'll give you the last word.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I feel very strongly the way you do, and I think that the fact that we're sitting on $700 million of unclaimed assets that rightfully belong to Minnesotans is really a shame. I think we can do better. I think this bill will help us do better, and I would like to respectfully ask for your support.
With that, the chair renews his motion to have House File 587 as amended laid over for possible inclusion in a later bill. Thank you, Representative Barr. Representative Mahoney. Does 10 or not? Representative Mahoney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And committee members, I'd like to move House File 1038.
Representative Mahoney moves House File 1038 for possible inclusion in a later bill. Representative Mahoney, to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a small amendment to House File 1038, the A9 amendment.
Representative Mahoney moves the A9 amendment to get the bill in the form that he would like. Seeing no discussion, all those in favor, please signify by saying aye. Aye. Opposed, say nay. Motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. Representative Mahoney, to your bill.
Mr. Chair, House File 1038, if you read the House research and overview, it is pretty clear. It's pretty straightforward. It removes the RDF and replaces it with the Energy Fund account. It continues on any encumbered funds that are now encumbered. It continues on with charging the $500,000 for the CAS at Parrot Island and the $350,000 for the CAS at Monticello. It requires that any monies placed into the energy account from those CAS be spent in Minnesota or in the XL ratepayers service area. It defines on page 2 at line 25, it starts to define what the monies can be spent on, and this is already in a previous bill, House File 235. Electric energy generated by solar, wind, or biomass, heat energy from solar, thermal, or geothermal, energy efficiencies, motor vehicles fueled by sources other than gasoline or diesel fuel, and energy storage. Page 3 basically deletes the RDF language. Bottom page 4, it terminates the charge on each CAS when it reaches $10 million. And for members' understanding, as I understand it from Excel, they are adding one or one and a half, basically one or two CAS every year or two. So it continually grows for the next 20, well, I think they're decommissioned in mid-30s, so it would be sometime kind of 15 or 20 years. And then it continues on. The bill continues the charge that it was set in the original bill, and I think it's it totals to about $12 million so long as the CAS are stayed after the plants are decommissioned. So long as those CAS stay there, it charges XL $12 million. Page 5, starting on line 10, this bill creates the Legislative Renewable Energy Council. It's a council of 11 members. 5 from the House, 5 from the Senate, 3 members of the majority, 2 of the minority, and 1 member from the Prairie Island Indian community. This bill requires that in this age of bipartisanship, it requires that you have 8 votes. So you have to get at least 1 minority member along. And I may be happy to open that, make that even higher now that we've added in the last committee the Prairie Island Indian community, but there's no reason why a majority should be able to just run this through on a 50% plus one. It also requires that 8 members of the legislature have districts with at least 60% of their residents getting the electric service from the utility that owns the nuclear power generating station. The other 2 have to have XL ratepayers in their district. And at this time, if the page is close at hand, I'll just hand this over. This is a map, and I'm trying to keep my costs down and not print multiple colored maps. About half of us, or better, are eligible for this at one way or another. The way they formed the service area, there seemed to be no rhyme or reason. Where they, if NSP was serving that particular area, that's who got, that's, they stayed with XL, and then wherever it went. And now, in many cases, you have towns that have grown, so the area outside of XL's rate service area has gone to the co-op, or the, you know, wherever, and the town center stays with XL. It's quite a learning experience.
Representative Mahoney, it is. I think we know why the lines are messed up, and that's because the lines were drawn by Mr. Rick Evans. That's why they don't make any sense.
You know, I've seen him get angry. I would be careful.
Continue with your testimony, Representative Mahoney.
The rest of the bill talks about how the committee, how the council is set up, elects a chair, vice chair, when it brings its council recommendations to the legislature, December 15th in the long year, February 15th in the odd year. There's a conflict of interest section, much boilerplate conflict of interest. There is a section that talks about the legislative auditor must audit the energy fund. There's a piece, and I've been a pretty big advocate of accountability here. When you're going to make a grant, you typically have an idea of what you're going to do. Or you're going to do a research project. You know, so you define what you think you're going to find, how you're going to find it, and then what you, the end of it, you tell what you're going to find. I want them to do that with any proposal that comes in front of this energy council. Because I think in this day and age, we need to be careful with the dollars that we're getting. And this is essentially a tax on XL Energy ratepayers. So I want accountability. I want us to make good decisions. The expenditures are, that's the accomplishment plan on page 7. On page 7, line 22, it talks about the energy fund may include but is not limited to research and development projects. I'm a little unsettled by that, but I was told by someone that was a good idea, and I decided to keep it in. General fund, page 7, line 25, if general fund money is put into this account, then it can be spent anywhere in the state. Mr. Chair, committee members, that's what I have. That explains the bill. I'll stand for questions.
Thank you, Representative Mahoney. And just to be clear, the vast majority of this, the content of House File 1038, is language that was adopted on your amendment that was attached to Representative O'Neill's bill on the House floor. Is that correct? Representative Mahoney?
Mr. Chair, yes.
Do you have any invited testifiers, Representative Mahoney?
No, Mr. Chair.
This is a public hearing. Are there any members of the public who wish to testify in favor or voice concerns with the bill? It looks like Jessica Hellman. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
All right. Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman Gruffalo and committee members. My name is Jessica Hellman. I'm a professor and the director of the Institute on the Environment at the University of Minnesota, which is a system-wide institute, and we have hundreds of experts on energy, agriculture, and issues related to the environment. And thank you, Representative Garofalo, Mr. Chair, for the opportunity to talk to the committee about House File 1038. And I want to raise four concerns as we see them from the institute at the university that I'd like to share with you today. And I want to start with reminding that the Renewable Development Fund was created so that Minnesota could innovate its way to a renewable energy future. It was designed to counteract the harms of nuclear waste. HF 1038 and a number of related bills before the House and Senate committees this week seek to modify those expenditures or those funds of more or less $25 million annually. So four concerns. Our first concern is that the funding process in this bill fails to include technical expertise. We are concerned that it does not describe a decision-making process that can identify innovative renewable energy activities. For example, it doesn't take advantage of internationally recognized energy researchers that we have within our state universities. We strongly recommend, and is our experience with this program, a process that includes leading energy experts that understand national trends, emerging technologies, and innovations. And we think these people are needed to find cost-effective solutions, including commercializable products. Our second concern is that the proposed bill does not explicitly include research, including basic research that fuels our state's innovation pipeline. The bill removes the explicit role for research in realizing Minnesota's energy future. We think this could represent a significant loss of economic and commercialization opportunity for Minnesota and reduce our leadership in energy technology, renewable energy technology. Our third concern is that the bill restricts the benefits, or who benefits, from the RDF by directing $25 million or its annual expenditures to a small geography and limiting the service of legislators on the council. It essentially can remove or reduce the benefits of renewable energy for rural communities, including the benefits of research. And a fourth concern is that the bill restricts the amount of renewable energy investment in the form of the $10 million funding cap per cask of nuclear waste, limits payments into the fund, and this can limit investment in our growing renewable energy industries. So I would like to share with you, the Institute on the Environment administers a block grant currently from Xcel of $3 million over 3 years under the RDF, and I brought with me today a description of four research projects that those funds support. And this document describes the tangible benefits these projects are delivering to Minnesota residents and utility customers. These projects represent a competitive granting process. They were vetted by experts beyond the university, and they received substantial oversight and guidance by a review board. And the projects broadly benefit residents in agricultural regions of the state and in Iron Range. So we are concerned that HF 1038 could undermine some of the core values and principles that are reflected in these example projects. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Any questions for the testifier? Ms. Hellman, I have a question for you. Early on, you laid out some criteria and concerns about decision makers, and I have to tell you that I agree with some of those concerns. That's why in 2011, when the legislature passed a law prohibiting the legislature from appropriating any funds from it, I supported that bill. Ms. Hellman, are you aware of what happened the next year after that law was passed?
Mr. Chairman, I will admit I do not, because I was not here nor directing this institute at that time. I do know that this is why I specifically referenced the funds that we are in charge of now, so I can't really comment broadly on the RDF funds. But I know that how we are stewarding these resources probably reflect some of those concerns that you have about accountability and direct relationship to commercialization. So I can't comment on things that for which I wasn't.
I must be in the legislature too long to not want to tell a story, right?
Come on, Lynn.
So again, in 2011 and 2012, the legislature passed and the governor signed a proposal that prohibited the legislature from spending any of the money in the RDF. It was to allow exactly what you just suggested, which is have the professional, technical experts make these decisions based on the criteria that were defined in law with no involvement from the legislature. The next year, the legislature came in and spent $175 million. They simply changed the law. And so while I admire your goals, I would tell you that we tried this once before. We tried insulating it from the legislature. We put it in law and said you can't spend it. And the next legislature came along and spent a lot of money, and they didn't really spend it in a way that is consistent with the principles you're recommending. So I don't want to speak for the author, But I know that the majority of the legislature and the majority of this committee, the intent was we have to fix this. And a two-track process right now where some people go to the board and follow the rules and other people come to the legislature and cut to the front of the line doesn't work. So, Ms. Helen.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, thank you. Let me be clear. My critique is not that there shouldn't be legislative oversight. My concern is that in the bill, as stated, there isn't an explicit role for how that expert opinion will take place. So I would, again, thinking about how we're stewarding these resources and my personal familiarity with how the research process works, I think that the role of that expertise, including an adequate timeline for those research proposals to be vetted for their viability and how interesting they are and whether or not they'll yield economic development opportunities, I don't see that reflected in here. So my critique is maybe slightly different or less directed toward whether or not there's legislative oversight.
So in the past, there was a direct appropriation that went to your organization.
Mm-hmm.
If we did that again, would that change your position on the issue?
Well, again, I wasn't here, Mr. Chairman, at that time. I do have some information, or at least some back-of-the-envelope calculations we've done on how those were spent because I wasn't here at that time. No, I'm not here advocating for a direct appropriation to the university. The university, I'm confident, will benefit from the opportunity to seek research development funds, provided that expertise and the evaluation of that, the merits of the research proposal are there. My concern is that those priorities aren't specified in this legislation. I'm not seeking a line item in the budget.
And just to be clear, for the record, I did not think you were seeking that appropriation, but I was saying
would I be happy?
As going forward, if the legislature was to partner with you, would that be something that would address your concerns?
Mr. Chairman, let me think about that.
Good answer.
let me study that. I'll come back. No. So of my four concerns about the technical advice, working collaboratively with the university would address my first concern about a role of technical review, though not exclusively the university, of course. I suppose it would also address my second concern about explicit inclusion of basic fundamental research, which you would find at the University of Minnesota and across the entire system and other state universities. I don't think it would address my third or fourth concerns about beneficiaries, statewide beneficiaries versus I do have a concern that research tends to, like the four that I will share with you all, tends to have broad beneficiaries that could be challenging to label as having direct benefit in the Excel. Of course, it would have benefit in the Excel Service District, but it would have broader benefit as well.
But as Representative Mahoney has said, if we put general fund dollars into this, there'd be no prohibition on funding that type of research with this fund.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I guess that would be up for you guys to decide, not for me to decide. Yes.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Are there any other members of the public who wish to testify?
I do want to check this out. May is that appropriate?
Yep.
I do have electric copies of the
page. Your page?
Thank you.
Why don't you give that to the page?
And members, as our next testifier comes down, we literally got the fiscal note on this bill like about a half hour ago. So I want to thank our staff. Our committee page went out and got copies of it. This is the updated fiscal note. I have not had a chance to review it, but the fiscal note is in everyone's packets and is available for review. And again, we would have got it to you earlier, but we literally just got it. So welcome to the committee, sir. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is John Knapp. I'm with the Winthrop & Weinstein Law Firm in Minneapolis, and I represent the Prairie Island Indian community. The Prairie Island Indian community has a very specific interest in the legislation that is before you because this legislation came out of the 1994 legislation allowing dry cast storage of nuclear waste at the Prairie Island Nuclear Generating Plant. As this bill has been going through the process, we've worked with Representative Mahoney to refine the bill, and we're very appreciative of the fact that Representative Mahoney offered an amendment in the prior committee to put a representative of Prairie Island on the advisory council that will be administering these funds. There was another provision of the bill that just came to our attention this afternoon that I wanted to point out to the committee and to the author of the bill, and that is related to the provisions on lines 2.31 and 2.33, which makes Minnesota, as amended, Minnesota ratepayers of Xcel the only parties that can benefit from the Renewable Development Fund. Well, even though the Prairie Island Indian community is only 600 yards from the Prairie Island Nuclear Generating Plant, they are not on the Xcel system. They're on the Dakota Electric system. And consequently, the way the language reads right now, they would not be eligible to apply for a grant from the Renewable Development Fund. So we just asked the committee and the author to consider adding language either now or as the bill goes forward to make the Prairie Island Tribe eligible to receive funding. I might also add that since the Renewable Development Fund was created, there has been a Prairie Island representative on the Advisory Council. They've been intimately involved in the fund as it has made awards. And as a matter of fact, under existing fund procedures, applications from the Prairie Island Tribe are given a preference, assuming all things otherwise being equal technically and on financial merit, they're given a preference in the award of grants from the fund. So I just bring that issue to your attention and would ask the committee and the author to bear it in mind as you go forward.
Thank you. Representative, first of all, are there any other testifiers? Any members of the public wish to testify? Okay, so Representative Mahoney, and then we'll go to Mr. Grant. Representative Mahoney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee. I'm certainly willing to work. I thought I had read the bill pretty clearly and gone through the history pretty clearly, but if that's been something that's been a legacy piece to the tribal community down there, I'm certainly willing to work and take a look at whatever language we can come to.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Grant. While Mr. Grant is coming on, are there any other members of the public who wish to testify in favor or voice concerns of the bill? Seeing none, we'll close the public comment portion and we'll give the final public testimony. Mr. Grant, please introduce yourself for the tape.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. Bill Grant for the Department of Commerce. And the department does have some concerns with the bill. First, I'd note that the concerns that have been raised about appropriations from the fund that members have considered problematic are largely those that have been made by the legislature itself, including, of course, the Innovative Energy Project, the Excelsior Coal Gasification Project, and more recently the Made in Minnesota program, which has raised concerns as well. So moving to an entirely legislatively controlled fund, will that solve the problem or just magnify it? That's concern number one. Second issue deals with an issue raised by the earlier testifier about lack of subject matter expertise on the proposed Renewable Energy Council. And I think this raises the risk that funding decisions from the fund are more likely to be determined by a successful lobbying effort rather than the actual merit of the proposal. And I think that the model that has been used by the fund to date with a board that does have that expertise has certainly proven to be a more reliable way of identifying projects that will benefit the state and will meet the goals of identifying a transition strategy away from nuclear power. A couple of other difficulties I'll note with the bill. One is that in determining that expenditures only benefit Xcel ratepayers, that's a pretty difficult bar to reach when you're talking about research projects in particular or even demonstration projects. Obviously, demonstration projects can be located in the district or in Xcel service territory, but I think it's much more difficult to say that benefits from those projects would be confined to that service territory. So that the council could find that that's a difficult bar to overcome. This bill lists specific technologies that could be used, that the money could be used for. I'll simply point out that, one, the list includes energy, clean energy sources that aren't necessarily renewable energy. So there's maybe a bit of a disconnect between the title of the council and the purposes to which they can put money. But the larger point is that what we would deem to be useful technologies are likely to change over time, and putting this language in statute may limit some options going forward that the council would want to consider but would be prevented from considering given the specific language. And then finally, Mr. Chairman, even with the inclusion of the Prairie Island member on the council, and I certainly don't want to speak for the Prairie Island community, but it's not clear that this bill really honors the 1994 agreement to identify technologies and resources to help us transition away from nuclear power. So I'd be happy to take any questions the committee might have.
Questions for members of the committee? I have a quick question. You've highlighted some concerns with the language. Does the department have suggestions on how to make the current program better?
Mr. Chairman, we'd certainly be happy to work with the author.
Are there any? Do you have any suggestions now, though?
Mr. Chairman, I do not.
Okay. And you highlighted correctly Excelsior Energy, the Made in Minnesota program. What I described earlier, where the legislature passed a law prohibiting itself from appropriating the funds in the next year, just for the record, is that what happened?
That's my understanding, Mr. Yeah. Chairman.
Just want to make sure in case, like, yep. You know, it's me, right? So Mr. Eloff, did you have a comment?
Mr. Chair, I just wanted to point out an element of the bill that some people have, to some degree, drawn some attention to. On lines 531 and 532, the bill states that the Legislative Coordinating Commission may contract with consultants as necessary to support the functions of the council. I think that allows contracting with consultants that can have expertise in various areas of energy that can help the council make decisions on individual programs.
Thank you, Mr. Ila.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Clark.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Grant, I think you were pointing out also that some of the purposes for which the fund can be used, I guess it's on line 7.22 to 7.24, means any kind of research and development. Doesn't necessarily have anything to do with renewable energy. Was that your point that you were talking about there?
Commissioner Grant.
I'm sorry, on which?
Well,
Representative Clark.
It was your point about what the research can...
Yes.
I was referring,
Mr. Chairman, and, yes, and Representative Clark, to the language on lines
2.25 to 2.23. Mr. Chairman. Your point was that it doesn't have to be renewable energy, I believe, is what you were referring to. Is that correct?
Commissioner Grant.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Clark, that's right. I don't regard energy efficiency, for example, or energy storage as renewable energy.
Representative Clark.
Okay. Could you give me an example, Mr. Chairman, Representative Mr. Grant?
Well, Mr. Chairman and Representative Clark, I do believe that the three sources listed on line 2.26 are, in fact, renewable energy sources.
Representative Clark.
No, I agree with you, Mr. Chairman, Mr. Grant. Those are ones that do apply, that would come under renewable energy. But I think if you're pointing out energy efficiency, it could be anything. Is that your point?
Mr. Chairman and Representative Clark, it covers a lot of ground, and yeah.
Mr. Chairman?
Representative Clark.
Mr. Grant, it could even be nuclear power.
Mr. Grant. Commissioner Grant.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Clark, no, I wouldn't consider it a generating resource to be an energy efficiency measure.
Excuse me, Mr. Chairman. Maybe I didn't ask that clear enough. Not to be the number three energy efficiency, but other forms of energy, electric energy, that could be generated. I think what I was referring to, I thought you were referring to, was back on line 7.22, 7.24.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Clark, as I read that language, it's describing the type of expenditures that can be made from the fund rather than the specific technologies that could be considered under the fund. So I think the council would have to consider both issues when determining whether or not expenditures from the fund would be appropriate or not.
Okay. Representative Clark.
Maybe my final question would be then, do you see that this bill would allow in that place or other places looking at nuclear energy development and expansion as a possibility under this bill?
Commissioner Grant.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Clark, I don't see that in the language, but I would defer to Representative Mahoney and his intent.
Okay, Mr. Chairman, maybe I'll ask Representative Mahoney.
Representative Mahoney?
Representative Mahoney, does your bill make it possible for some of those funds to be used in nuclear energy development?
Representative Mahoney.
Research.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman, Representative Clark. No.
Representative Clark.
Mr. Chairman, without stating that, Representative Mahoney, I think we might need to, if your intention is not to, is to continue that purpose, the original purpose, to find alternatives to renewable energy, which was part of the original purpose, if your intention is to do that, maybe, I guess what I'd ask you to do is let's find a place in the bill to say that.
Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't even know where to begin. Mr. Grant, you said that energy efficiency is not renewable, but when I went to Germany with these folks right here and we looked at the German model for getting to 80% renewable by 2050, I was taken back by their energy portfolio moving forward. And 49% of their energy portfolio moving forward was in additional energy conservation or in energy efficiency, 49%. So the German model actually embraces that as part of their portfolio of moving forward, how to embrace renewable energy. So I would challenge that perception because, you know, they're light years ahead of what we're doing. That's what I keep getting told. So, but that wasn't really my point. So my question actually is to the author, because I noticed that this is quite a bit of a language that we worked on together and that passed in my bill, but it doesn't have the Made in Minnesota solar incentive repeal, and I'm wondering if you could address that as to why you didn't put that in here. And then the other question I have for the author is, as I was trying to calculate out and look at the map and trying to figure out for my own district, would I even qualify as one of the eight that could be chosen, and I have the nuclear power plant in my district. It's not clear to me, and I've calculated it every which way. I looked at the map. I did a population of, you know, I know how many my population is of 2010 census, and I tried to figure out which of those regions were Xcel Energy territories and which ones were not. And it's not clear to me if I'd even be included in that. And I have the nuclear power plant in my district. So could you answer those two questions for me?
Representative Mahoney.
This bill does not address Made in Minnesota solar. And I'm not opposed to incentives for solar. I think they have shown at some level to be useful. What this bill does is continue the any encumbered funds that we've made with the Made in Minnesota solar. It doesn't cut anybody off at this particular point. But again, I'm not opposed to something being formed in the successor to the RDF fund that would do that. I don't want to see, and I hope I don't offend anybody, but I don't want to see solar become the next ethanol subsidy forever until it becomes a huge floor fight. But I would like to see them weaned off. I mean, wind energy is now at a level that it's competitive, everybody else. So that answers that question. The other is 60% was I wanted to get to the number of I wanted people on this committee that actually have – there's an old saying, you know, taxation without representation is tyranny. I want the people to be represented that are getting their money taken. We have spent hundreds of millions of dollars out of XL ratepayers' area for projects statewide. We have now got more solar and more wind, or we are very, very close to having more solar and more wind than all three reactors create. We have reached that level, that if this stopped, we've replaced, or we are very close to replacing, the generation from the nuclear stations. This is, again, $1 billion by the time it's over, or better, just in the next 25 years, and if it goes on farther, but up to the 25 years, it's $1 billion out of XL ratepayers' service area to fund research that they may or may not profit from, to put solar panels or wind towers or biomass in places that they don't live. I'm very, very frustrated that my constituents are not getting what they're paying for. We get research assistants and graduate students at the U. But that doesn't help my district. That doesn't help the district next to me. That doesn't help the little old lady that's living on $30,000 from a pension from 30 years ago. But the Made in Minnesota Solar has helped an awful lot of people on the west side of St. Paul, on the west half of St. Paul, where the average income is four times the average income in my district. Where people live in my district that have money, I see solar panels. I do not see solar panels in areas of my district where people are living at or below the median income. If we're going to design a program, and I would, who's ever on this committee, I hope I can get on it, I would love to design a program that helps people of modest means get solar panels, because that takes away the cost of their utilities. But I am tired of seeing the person on the lake with 12 solar panels up, and they come to me and say, well, I got it for $20,000 because, you know, there's this program in Minnesota that gave me like 60% of it. So I could go on. You're 60% if it needs to go down to 50% plus one person, but it does need to have a majority of people that are having the money taken out of their pocket on that committee.
Representative O'Neill.
Thank you. I appreciate your passion. I feel the same way because I do have, I don't know what the percentage is in my district, but I have a lot of Xcel Energy ratepayers in my district. And I hear you. That is exactly the concern. And on top of that, you know, I also, Wright County is kind of ground zero for utility scale solar, which at least it, you know, now it's competitive, but you know, there's been issues back and forth with land use and everything else. I hear your concern, and I share that. My only concern is the legislators, the House and Senate members that have the Xcel Energy nuclear power plant in their district should probably be on the council. That would be my only request, that the Prairie Island and the Monticello representatives probably should be on that. Absolutely, we need people that you know, have skin in the game. That's what you're trying to say, is, you know, people that have been paying, and you said $1 billion. I haven't calculated it that far out, but $1 billion. That's a lot of money out of the pockets. And, you know I had a long conversation, Representative Mahoney, with Xcel Energy, and it's not just the fact that it's this, the RDF, but it's other things that we, the legislature, have put upon the Xcel Energy ratepayers to the tune of 10% of their bill for commercial is because of the stuff that the legislature said they had to do, like biomass and the RDF and solar incentives. So it is a real cost of doing business. And for the residential, that's 5% of our bill is from that. So I think we need to be, as a legislature, incredibly mindful of what we're putting upon the backs of, like you said, the grandma that's on a fixed income, because that's who it impacts. And also the businesses that, are we driving them out of our Xcel Energy ratepayers' service territories, which, as you can see, that's quite a bit of the
Mr.
metro.
Chair?
Representative
Quickly, I'm not so concerned about driving businesses out. I'm more concerned about attracting businesses in because of the high cost of energy. But that's just the way I look at it.
Representative Anderson.
I'm going to get in trouble on ethanol now, I know.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. I do have to correct my fellow Ag Committee member that there are no more subsidies, state or federal, for ethanol.
No.
Okay. I just had one question for Mr. Grant. And I think I heard you correctly when you said you saw no connection between energy storage and renewable energy. Is that correct?
Mr. Grant.
Mr. Chairman and Representative, what I said was energy storage is not a renewable energy source. And I was merely pointing out the same issue with energy efficiency, that if you're going to call this the Legislative Renewable Energy Council, You've expanded the scope from that to include things that are clearly not renewable energy on their own.
Representative Anderson.
Okay, thanks for that clarification. But I would just say that, in my opinion, energy storage would be a key to advancing renewable energy. If we can solve that storage piece, it would make wind and solar so much more practical and almost baseline. But if you didn't say what you thought I did say, I stand corrected.
And Mr. Chair, I certainly didn't intend in any way to denigrate the usefulness of either energy efficiency or energy storage, merely pointing out the language difference.
And Representative Anderson, it's important that in Minnesota we have renewable energy, but we don't call hydro renewable, so this is kind of consistent with that. So, Representative Neuberger, then Makeway, then McGinnis. Representative Neuberger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You just teed up my next golf shot here. Representative Mahoney, would you just look at line 2.30 on your bill? I would really like to get, since we're putting this through the sausage grinder that is the legislature, I just need you to define. Energy storage has, in some regards, been defined as by water. We have some communities that only charge up their water heaters at night because they're considered energy storage. Henceforth, we do have some form of a precedent there. So the potential energy that is stored in water, in my opinion, and in yours, does that include hydro?
Representative Mahoney.
In my opinion, in the court systems, what we say in this committee or what we intend really has no value. The way that energy storage is here and phrased here and purposefully phrased here is it's very broad. Representative Anderson talked about battery storage. I think that's a great idea. If it's water, if you could figure out how to store it in the air, I'd be happy with that too.
Representative Neuberger.
Well, thank you, Representative Mahoney, because the potential energy that's in the water that's behind the Hoover Dam pretty much powers half the state of Colorado. That is stored energy. And I would like to make sure that we have that defined because, as Chair Garofalo had mentioned, hydro is probably the cleanest, cheapest, and best renewable, and yet this state refuses to recognize it, and to our shame. I could go on all day about hydro, but I just wanted to define that. And the second thing I wanted to touch on, Mr. Chair, and thank you for indulging me here, our first testifier, the woman from the University of Minnesota, I'm sorry, I forgot your name. I'm sorry. Ms. Hillman, the director, thank you for your testimony. I do want to address one of the comments that you made about the bill. You had said that this bill included nothing for research and that the university has a lot to offer. I agree in that part of your statement. However, this legislature has been funding research for energy and renewable energy to the tune of probably billions of dollars. I'm just looking right here at just one example, the LCCMR bill in 2016. There were 19 proposals. 16 of them were energy related, and of there were 8 that were selected, and of the 8, 6 were to the University of Minnesota, and they're all you can look it up online. There are the minimum one here is about $250,000, and it goes all the way up to about $1.8 million. So, is the University of Minnesota? I mean, I'm going to spare the committee the time, but it runs the entire spectrum of energy research here. So we are funding energy research to the tune of $12,690,000 to the university if this passes through LCCMR. So the premise that we are not funding any research for renewable energy, I would challenge you to go look at some of the other bills that go through some of the other committees, because we are pouring money into research buckets. And to be quite frank with you, you know, research is great, but let's start seeing some results. I'm tired of a one-sided approach. And if this committee gets us to results, then I support this bill. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Wiggins.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I asked to be recognized.
Did you see me?
Yeah.
Okay. I asked to be recognized when we were talking about energy storage. So I'd like to make a point on that and then also be recognized when you close public testimony.
Of course.
Okay. But on the energy storage, because we took the word renewable away and renewable does not govern this list, this energy storage could be a gas tank. It could be an oil tank. So this, I just point that out to you. So it has nothing to do with renewable. With regard to the LCCMR and our pouring money in, if you will, there is something different about LCCMR. And for members, if there a patent is obtained from an LCCMR project, LCCMR, that is the state, gets cut. And that comes back to the state. So LCCMR projects are not just throwing money. It is also looking for return on the dollar. So that is a very specific requirement for LCCMR, and folks have to sign things and whatever. So with that, just a note.
Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. To that point, I spent 2 years serving on LCCMR, and when I was new, this topic of discussion came up in the committee, and I asked staff how much money the state of Minnesota had gotten back in these, I'll call them royalties or whatever. And guess what the answer was that I was given that day? Zero.
Representative Wiggins, welcome to the Committee on Natural Resources, ladies and gentlemen. Representative Wiggins.
Well, one of the reasons for that would be that doing research is fairly recently on LCCMR. So before, it was very different buying parks and trails and things like that. So none of this has matured to the point that might happen. That's all.
Commissioner Grant, did you want to chime in on the LCCMR?
No? Mr. Chairman, I do.
Before we go to Representative Wiggins' closing comments and then the author, any other comments from members of the committee? Representative Wiggins, you get the last word before the author.
Okay. Well, one of the things that you brought up, Mr. Chair, is that you need to solve this problem of the legislature not appropriating the money appropriately. But this bill does not stop that. Legislature still can use this money to buy roads and bridges. It just becomes general fund money under this bill. That's all it is, general fund money. So before, at least it had that renewable, and there was a long-term agreement, so people actually felt they had to keep in that direction. But with the language that we have here, so we've taken away renewable. We've taken away the language on 3.1 to 3.12, which is very specific in terms of outcomes. And we've changed that to language on 2.25 to just categories where you can spend the money. No outcomes whatsoever. So I think in that respect, we are going backwards and way backwards. So the money can be spent pretty much on anything, no outcomes, just categories. One of them could be gas tanks. So we're not there yet. I understand the desire for reform, but this is not it.
Representative Mahoney, you're the author. You get the last word.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Oh, I'm sorry. Representative Clark wanted you. Wanted to, Representative Clark?
Yeah, thank you. And I'm glad to turn it over to the author. I just wanted to, a couple of comments. So what we're doing in this bill is what we did in the previous bill, this topic, which is to do away with the original intent of the legislation, which was to provide an alternative to nuclear power. And it has not changed by simply putting one number on the voting body from Prairie Island. Certainly the outnumber was 10 to 1. There was 10 other members, right? On the previous advisory committee, there was one Prairie Island member, as I recall. But what we're not doing is dealing with the long-term problem that the Prairie Island community lives with, which is the storage of high-level nuclear waste very close to them. That was the agreement. That was the reason that we made that agreement years ago. It wasn't to get to a certain level of renewable energy and then say, okay, now we're done, and we've met that agreement. No, the agreement is thousands of years in the making and should last for thousands of years unless we can possibly ever have a federal repository for nuclear waste. So, I mean, we are again, and I talked about this in the front of the House, and it's so painful to realize that we are again breaking an agreement that we made with Native American people about our ability to have nuclear power that jeopardizes them. And I just want the community to continue to remember that and for all of us to be reminded that we are breaking it in this bill as we did in the previous bill. And it's just wrong. This state has a long history of breaking every single treaty we ever have made with Native American people in the state, every single one. This is not a treaty, but it is a common promise that we made that really deeply impacts people's lives and their livability, their ability to survive as a people, the long-term effects and even the short-term effects of radioactive waste on human beings is well documented. And so I just want to make it clear that that's what we're doing again if we continue to pass this kind of legislation. We're going away from the original intent, and it's just extremely disturbing at this legislature, and I hope that others would think about that. And Representative Mahoney, when I asked you whether or not nuclear power could be one of the energies that would be developed in here, and you said that was not, you said no. But I would like to see at least that go into the bill. In addition, I'm sure it's going to pass here today, and perhaps it will pass on the floor again. I would like to say at least that much we can offer to the Prairie Island people.
Representative Clark, we're actually laying this bill over, so we're not going to be voting on it today. So on that issue, at least, that gives us all time to, Representative Mahoney and others, take a look at this language and work on it. Representative Mahoney, you're the author. You get the final word.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and there's lots of things that could be said here. This bill is moving forward, I hope, in the omnibus bill. I'm happy to work with any and all, and I think my door has always been open. Those that have walked in and asked or called or emailed, I have tried to accommodate them in this particular piece. To my colleague, Representative Wagenius, thank you for the note on the gasoline. I think it does need to be more specific, and if you've got other suggestions, please pass them along. Representative Clark, I don't know how nuclear power could be tied into this, but if there's a way we can make you more comfortable, what would make you even more uncomfortable is to see what we've paid already to try and then been stymied to try to find a repository for the spent fuels. Members, I think you heard my speech earlier. I am very frustrated that the RDF has gone all over the map and really not helped the people in the state of Minnesota that really needed the help, people who have less than we. And that's why I came to this legislature, and I think this bill starts there. I don't think it's done. I think once it gets into an omnibus bill, if that's where it's going to end up, I promise you I will work to make it meet the concerns. So thank you for your time today.
Thank you, Representative Mahoney. And with that, Representative Mahoney renews his motion to have House File 1038 laid over, amended, laid over for possible inclusion in a later bill. Members, one quick announcement. Tomorrow evening is the Regents election. So we're going to not have committee tomorrow so that people don't... Yeah, I know you'll miss me. So no committee meeting for tomorrow. I think the announcement's been posted, just making sure everyone hears that. But Representative New, you still have to be here. Yes, so. Any other announcements or questions from members of the committee? Seeing none, we are adjourned. Thank you.